I've got a beagle bone here in a box. I'm going to pass it around. Feel free to open up the box. It's got exactly in it what you would get if you ordered a beagle bone the next time George puts together an order for beagle bones for Nice Bud. Take a look at it. Feel free to look at it. Owing to the fact that I don't want it blown up by static, let's leave it in the static bag as we pass it around. Okay. Now, caveat, I'm not one of these super presentation type kind of guys. This is my first shot at doing a presentation with LibreOffice or OpenOffice or anything like that. Whoop, and guess what? I'm at the end of this. I'm at the very end. See there? Told you. Okay. All right. So, in spite of what was up on the NiceBug site, I entitled this talk, Keep and Arm FreeBSD. And the reason for that goes along with the why should I care, which we will get into momentarily. But the questions up here on the screen are what I hope to answer tonight. Why should you care? Is it usable? What kind of hardware is there? Can you actually do anything useful with it? How do you get started? How do you get an OS on the machine? Hey, I'm not a kernel hacker. What the heck can I do? This thing's in its infancy, this effort. And what resources are available? So that's what I hope to communicate to you guys tonight. Any questions at any time, raise your hand. If I don't notice your hand, yell at me. Try not to throw anything at me. I'm supposed to be going out with my wife after this. So, okay. So, on to the next slide. Why should you care? One, the hardware is inexpensive. That BeagleBone that's getting passed around right now, $70. Raspberry Pi, the super ballsy Raspberry Pi, $35. You know, so you got cheap hardware that you can do an awful lot with. Instead of thinking, oh gosh, I got to spend $500, $800, $1,000 to get a machine for this project. No, you got to spend $35 to $100. Now, in reality, as we'll see a little bit later, you got to spend a little bit more than just the cost of the board. Why else should you care? These things are all open hardware designs, pretty much. The BeagleBone, the schematics are published. Anybody that decides they want to build a BeagleBone can build it in their basement or can contract out to a contract electronics assembly shop to build it for them. So it's totally open. Raspberry Pi is similarly open, although I believe not quite as open because it's got certain restrictions by the Raspberry Pi Foundation, but they also publish their schematics and everything. So just like we are using free software primarily because we can get in there and get at the bits if we need to do something or if we want to do something or we want to make improvements, same thing with the hardware platform here. It's open, it's examinable, and accessible. No UEFI problems. Does everybody here know what UEFI is? Okay, I did not hear a resounding yes, so I'll go into it just slightly. The Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. This is what's replacing the traditional BIOS interface in the x86/AMD64 world. The bad thing about this is that at certain levels, it enforces a lock on what software you can run, which is why there's been a lot of debate on the various Linux lists, the various FreeBSD lists, and no doubt Net and Open, although I don't really read those lists that much, about how the heck are we going to be able to boot our kernels on this. They got to be signed by Microsoft because Microsoft's got the master key burnt into the firmware. There was an article just the other day that came out on Slashdot about how to burn your own master key into one of these UEFI machines. certainly non-trivial. So at this point, as my friend Jay Sulzberger would say, these boards help you avoid the englobulators who are wanting to basically decide what you can run on your machine. Because the boot spec is open and, you know, it's not a problem for anybody to write a bootloader for it, and you don't have to worry about is the bootloader signed by Microsoft, is the kernel signed by Microsoft, that kind of thing. No vendor lock-in, because a lot of these boards are, as I said before, free and open designs. If vendor A decides they're going to stop producing the board, but you've come up with a brilliant use for it and a brilliant product based upon it, you've got everything you need to go to another contract vendor and say, hey, build me 1,000 boards so I can get my Super Widget 54 going. And you can go out and sell your Super Widget 54. So you don't have to worry about vendor lock-in. They're also very low power consumption. The power supply for the BeagleBone is spec'd out at 5 volts, 1.5 amps is the max you need. So, you know, you're talking a couple of watts there, which means that you lower your electric bill significantly. I don't know about you guys, but I've got 12 machines running in my house around the clock. My electric bill is quite substantial, especially since some of those machines are old x86 variety machines and suck lots of power. One of the things that I'm planning on doing with my little arm boards is replacing pretty much every one of those machines. I have a colleague in the engineering department at ISC that has replaced every single one of his home machines except his human interface machine, as he calls it, which is his laptop running some Debian variant, with these little arm machines, in his case Raspberry Pis. He's got a big x86 machine that the only thing that it does is it sits there turned off all the time, and once a night one of the ARM boards sends a wake on LAN signal to it. It boots up some version of GNU Linux. He backs up all his stuff from the day to his x86 machine from all these little ARM boxes he's got sitting around his house, and then he shuts the x86 machine down again. So basically, you can put these things anywhere. So, you know, you have one for your mail server, one for your name server, whatever. Automation tasks, they become cheap and easy. If you need to automate something, you don't have to worry, oh, well, you know, we need 5 controllers for 5 different locations, and those controllers are 300, 400 bucks a piece. These things, you know, at the $35 to $75 level, they've got lots of I/O capability using general purpose I/O, which is essentially single bit I/O. You know, you can turn things on, you can turn things off. You can get 1 and 0 sensor input. You can also get more than just 1 and 0 values on the sensors, but I'm not 100% up on GPIO operation yet. That's sort of like my next stage in learning about these things. But there, you know, you've got the I/O lines where you can put in sensors for things like thermostats, water sensors, etc. You can do relay outputs to turn things on and off, that sort of thing. So, you know, it'll essentially allow you to do the kind of tasks the guys with the Arduinos are doing, but you've got a much richer, much bigger toolbox since you've got the entire Unix toolbox. and you've got a bit ballsier system to work with. So cheap and easy automation tasks. Okay, is it usable? It actually is usable. And to that end, we're going to take a break from the slides. See if I can do this. And the left-hand window is my Raspberry Pi back in Brooklyn. You can see that it's running EPMD there a couple of times near the top. This particular machine happens to be running a Jabber server, eJabberD. Unfortunately, you can only connect to it from localhost because of my shortcomings in trying to figure out how to configure eJabberD. But I was able to build 80-some ports. Let me see what it was. I think it's 88.
Good question. So, can you just, whichever window you're going to talk about,
yep.
Can you blow it up a bit?
Blow it up a bit. Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's see here. Is that big enough?
Yep.
Okay. So, let's see here. Okay, so 88 packages I've built on this thing, and I've actually built them right on this machine. You can see my root device is a 4 gig SD card, and DA0 is a 16 gig USB stick. And ports are symlinked over to /X port so as to not run me out of space on the root drive. So yeah, it's usable. I built 88 ports in getting eJabberD up and running. And there was very little problem with it. So it certainly is useful. Let's go back over to let's see, start top so I don't get any timeouts here. Go back over to the slides. So it is actually usable. You can do most basic things that you'd expect to do on a FreeBSD machine. Total disclosure, the guys in the GNU Linux land seem to be ahead of us on this. They seem to have much more working functionality at this point, although we seem to be catching up. Not everything works. One of the reasons that I'm doing all my builds on the Raspberry Pi is because USB isn't working on the BeagleBone at the moment under FreeBSD. Although I had a small update on that just moments before I left my house to come here. A gentleman who's on the FreeBSD ARM list and in the FreeBSD ARM IRC all the time, Gonzo, said that he's had some small success with USB on the BeagleBone in the last 24 hours. He's actually written 8 bytes to a USB disk. So that's kind of that's the small success we're having.
Has he reread them?
Has he reread them?
Yes.
I don't know.
Only 7 of them.
I said, hey guys, I gotta go. I gotta give the talk. And he said, oh, I wrote 8 bits.
In bits or 8 bytes?
Bits. Because I've been after him for an update on the state of USB, knowing that I was gonna be talking tonight. The Raspberry Pi had. Yeah, George.
Right back because it fits right into what you're saying. Is that so? I tried to paint. The people gave us a discount on the BeagleBones initially with CircuitCo. People I met at Maker Faire in September. And I was like, hey, we're using your hey, and my usual I'll say bulldog style, I managed to get a discount and also an engineer for people who are paying, who Tim didn't actually speak to. But I'm also trying to find, because Circuco, I don't believe, is manufacturing the new improved BeagleBone that's cheaper and better. But I'm trying to find a contact who I can actually track down, because that advantage that the Linux people have is that there's Linux people involved already with the specs importing it. So
right.
It's been a little different spot. I tried to see if we can get some early copies of our early releases of the new BeagleBone. But the idea is that as a kind of foolish end user in the large BSD hierarchy, it's not that hard for me to go pick a vendor or a manufacturer and go, hey, I'm CCing someone who actually does developing. What's the chance of getting the specs? What's the chance of getting the hardware? Which, very much what Brett's talking about tonight is about this, but it's actually that role you can play as a non-dev. So
right.
Hopefully we'll have that same advantage if I could track somebody down.
So, not everything works. The Raspberry Pi's networking is slow by comparison to the BeagleBone. And we'll give you a quick demonstration on that. Flip over to the X session again. Okay, so this big window is the Raspberry Pi. And it is pinging an AMD 64 box that's on the same LAN. And that LAN doesn't have a lot of traffic, 10 milliseconds. So we're going to pop over here. Dude. All right. This is the BeagleBone. Notice the difference. Okay.
Can you tell us what those numbers are?
What's the difference? Well, the difference is considerable. The BeagleBone is pinging www.win.com at roughly half a millisecond. The Raspberry Pi, 10 milliseconds on the ping. They're literally all plugged into the same network switch. So what does that tell you? That tells you that the Raspberry Pi is lacking a little bit on its network. There are some problems with, while USB works on the Raspberry Pi, and they had to get USB working quickly on the Pi because its network interface is USB, UE0, that's a USB interface. It's on the board, you don't have to buy an extra bit, but it is a USB interface. While the what's that? Yeah, that's what it is running happiest at. I actually had to lock it in at half duplex to get it to be reasonably reliable.
You have to do the lock on which one, Pi or the BeagleBone?
On the Pi. I had to lock it in at half duplex. And yes, they are both plugged into 10 base T, not 100 base T or gig. The highest interface speed is 100 base T on these boxes. But they're such low performance boxes compared to other things that plugging it into a 10 meg switch, you know, made sense. So there happened to be some problems with the Pi. Question, yes?
Actually, a statement. One of the reasons you're going to find the BeagleBone to be a bit better is that the Pi isn't really a computer. The Pi's main chip is a Broadcom graphics chip with an extremely small bit of ARM on it. And so there's more oomph generally in the ARM that you have on the BeagleBone than in the ARM that you have on the Pi.
Excellent.
That's why you can do 1080p, because it's got, if you look at the chip under a microscope, most of it is graphics processor and it's a little tiny bit of ARM. And so that's why, it's one of the reasons you'll just find things to be, general processing to be faster on the BeagleBone, but if you wanted to do things like the video stuff people are doing, the art stuff that people are doing on the Pi, that works faster on the Pi. It's just a big graphic processor.
Ah, thanks. Appreciate it.
One question.
Yeah, Jay.
Standard chip, actually, I'll ask the question right in front of you.
Yes.
Is it a standard chip or is it one that they had made?
No, it's in, so the guy, one of the people on the Raspberry Pi board of directors is a director at Broadcom.
Right.
And was like, oh, we've got these chips laying around if you'd like them. And that's how Pi came to be.
Uh-huh. But of course, they've made a million of them.
Yeah,
so I guess
it's energy standard chip. It is a standard chip.
Excellent.
But as a general processor, it's low power as a general processor.
So the Raspberry Pi has some USB issues, which is one of the reasons that the networking is slower on the Raspberry Pi. Occasional USB lockups on the Pi, and I occasionally have experienced the network going out on the Pi. As a matter of fact, I was not 100% sure I'd have network connectivity to the Pi tonight. Just before I left my house, I had to get onto the Pi's console and do an ifconfig down and an ifconfig up to get the network back. And I was hoping that it would stay until I got here. Personally, I'm using my Pi as my main build machine for ARM because it's got the working USB. But anything that I would want to run of a reliable nature, I would run on the bone. And I can't wait until the bone has working USB. One of the problems that I've seen on both boxes are processes just occasionally dying. One of the processes that occasionally dies that has been reported by many people, SSH key, just occasionally dies. No core dump, no trace of anything. If you go on the console, you might see SSHD exited signal 11, I think. So there are occasional problems like that. You know, I would not use it for something that I considered to be absolutely business critical. But certainly I think at this point these machines are usable for some general purpose things that don't require high reliability, don't require high availability. As I showed you a few minutes ago, a lot of ports just build out of the box. Now when I went and built eJabberD, I did have one little problem with it. As it started to build Erlang, which I've never built before, it came back and said, hey, Erlang can't be built for ARM. And I said, how does it know? I went into the make file, I commented out the line that said, hey, check and see if you're running one of these architectures. I typed make again. Lo and behold, some hours later, I had a working eJabberD server. And I emailed the Erlang. Actually, I put a bug report in on the FreeBSD PR system saying, hey, ports claims Erlang can't build on ARM. I just did it. And the developer came back and said, great catch. Thanks a lot. And within 48 hours, Erlang was marked as buildable on ARM. So, you know, if you go to build something on one of these little ARM boxes and it doesn't work, if you've got a little bit of experience as a sysadmin, you don't have to be a hardcore developer. You might be able to figure out why it's not working and provide feedback to the port maintainer via the FreeBSD PR system and get that port fixed so that the next guy that comes along can just type make install or make package. All right, what hardware supported? We got the Raspberry Pi, the BeagleBone, the Panda Board, the EFCA, Versal PB, whole bunch of things. Others too. I took a short survey on the IRC channel of what guys were dealing with that they actually were able to get a shell on and do some useful work on, and this was the list that came back to me. Now these things work all in different varying amounts. At this point, I honestly believe the machine that has the most functionality is the Raspberry Pi. If it didn't have the USB lockups and the network going out to lunch from time to time, I would say it was the definite front runner, although I have, like I say, gotten intelligence that the Beagle Bone is getting closer. Matter of fact, we'll go into that a little bit more in a moment. Okay, what can you do with them? Are they powerful enough for anything? Well, consider this. I'm running a web server right now on a 486 at 133 megahertz with 48 megabytes of RAM. Now, that machine's running because, what the hell, it hasn't died, and it does what it needs to. I've got no real motivation to move anything other than, golly gee, it's sucking a lot of power at this point. These boards are a quantum leap more powerful than that. You know, and that machine can saturate a T1 with web service if it wants to. So, absolutely they're usable. Some of the things that I'm looking at using these things for: DNS servers, Tor servers, web servers, NTP servers, mail servers, and chat servers. Those are my personal hot button items. I used to be one of these admins that would say, hey, you know, don't get a different machine for every job because the machines are so powerful enough you can load lots of jobs on them. These things are so cheap that from the standpoint of availability and reliability, well, DNS server, what the heck? Throw up a pair of Beagle Bones to run your DNS, and then you don't have to worry if some other machine that's got lots of stuff on it has to go offline for some reason. Your DNS services are still going to be there. Yeah, George.
Just quick. So I've been running a Tor bridge out of my apartment on a Raspberry Pi for, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, but it's an old image of that's, I think, Gonzo or somebody had built that I used to on the SD card, and I've been running Tor on it. I have had no problems. I have no SSHD or any other lockups going on. And
I got to get your image.
I have no idea why or what, and it's an old revision, SVN revision, but it's probably doing, and probably doesn't mean anything to anybody unless you know Tor, but it's probably doing 16 or 20 circuits a day, which means like 16 10-minute sessions entryway, and it's, you know, getting hits from Iran and China and so on and so forth. So it's, I mean, it's actually doing stuff. It's not, you know, it's brilliant, but it's certainly operational and functional. But I do think, though, that, you know, if Tor is your thing, cool. If DNS is your thing, cool. You know, if Asterisk is your thing, cool. But I do think that what will make these much more widely popular, acceptable as functional, I'll say, distro type approach thing, is if people start playing with what they like to use. If it's DNS, go out and build a stock DNS box that people could download an image they do create on a regular basis and just go click, click, and have a fully functional DNS server running on a Raspberry Pi. You know, and totally second everything that Brett just argued about this, because people go way beyond what they need for the function, hardware-wise.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, these boxes, I say NTP server here, these boxes don't have real-time clocks on them, but once you sync them up to a Strata 1 NTP server, they'll make perfectly fine NTP servers. At the point where we've got good, reliable USB on them, you can even use these guys as firewalls. Absolutely no problem. They've got certainly enough bandwidth for firewalls for small to mid-sized businesses. Because, let's face it, my first firewall was a FreeBSD box supplied by my upstream vendor, TSI. FreeBSD running off a single floppy on a 386SX with 16 megabytes of RAM. So can these guys deal with being firewalls? Absolutely, as soon as the USB bugs are all worked out.
16 mega RAM on a 386?
386SX. That was my firewall supplied by...
That's a lot of RAM in that.
Supplied by PSI.
It's lot of RAM in a 386.
Okay, on to the next. How can you get started? Well, you can go out and buy a board. The BeagleBone's about $70. It's got less RAM than the current Raspberry Pi. What it does have that the Raspberry Pi does not have is built-in USB console. The Raspberry Pi, the console is either composite video and USB keyboard or HDMI video and USB keyboard. Considering I don't have an HDMI monitor, right now I'm running my Raspberry Pi into my television. Not pleasant to look at when you have to be on the console. Matter of fact, sometimes it's a challenge to tell what the output is. The BeagleBone can get its power over the USB connection that's used for the console, or it can get the power over a 2.1 millimeter coax adapter. When you power it over the USB, clock speed is slower because it can't draw as much current, so they limit the clock speed. Comes with 4G micro SD card with some variant of GNU Linux pre-installed on it. I would recommend that when you get it, go ahead and boot up GNU Linux. There's nothing evil with it. Boot it up, play with it a little bit. It's got a kind of nice web IDE interface for building web apps, and it's got a little demo to turn one of the lights on and off on the Raspberry Pi board, which sort of demonstrates how to work with GPIO under Linux. I booted mine up on the micro SD that came with it to make sure it worked right before I went and did anything else. Ethernet works in FreeBSD 10. USB, as I said before, isn't working. The GPIO headers, reports I have from other people are that they are working. They've actually done things with the GPIO headers, talking in and out of them. I haven't done it myself. And the BeagleBone has expansion boards called capes, similar to Arduino shields, that you can put on for various other functions. There are probably about 15 or 20 of them now that are actually out there where you can actually just order them from various vendors. The challenge there is going to be whether there is appropriate driver software under FreeBSD for the particular board. I haven't done any experimenting with any of these boards yet. Like I said before, that's sort of the second take for me on dealing with these things. The first take is I want to build little network appliances. And we're already very close to them being at that level. The other thing I like about the BeagleBone, it's got a reset button. So if the damn thing locks up, you don't have to unplug the plug. You can reach in and touch the reset button, and away you go. Your other option, you got the Raspberry Pi. Yeah,
is there much crossover between the developers and it seems to be very Linux-centric folks over at BeagleBone, or people who do all the Beagle boards? Has there been much crossover for some more of the usually in utilities, like the way that they do GPIO?
I haven't really seen any of that yet, Ike. I wish there was. But, you know, the people that are really heavily into that stuff at these vendors seem to be Linux-centric people. And so, you know, it's essentially we're still playing catch-up a little bit. The unfortunate thing, I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with one of the really prolific developers, a gentleman that goes by the tag of Gonzo. A lot of companies now are doing embedded devices based on these ARM boards or based on similar ARM boards that, you know, running the same chipset but developed for their devices. And they're doing it on Linux. Why? Well, because everybody does Linux, because every programmer knows Linux, because, you know, those kinds of arguments of, well, you know, everybody understands Linux, nobody understands BSD. And as a matter of fact, his company had been building embedded systems on FreeBSD on ARM for a number of years, and the president announced a couple months ago, oh, we're moving everything over to Linux across the board. Why? Well, because everybody knows Linux. I can swing a dead cat and hit a Linux guy. Yeah. So, unfortunately, no, not so much. Okay, I've already touched on the console for the Pi. Its root device is an SD or an SDHC card. The BeagleBone, it's micro SD. The power on the Pi is via a micro USB connection. That micro USB connection only carries power, no data. The two USB ports work. As I said, they don't work really well, but they work. And the Ethernet works with dropouts. The Pi also has GPIO expansion capability, and it's got a couple of proprietary expansion headers. Not proprietary, really, since the whole Pi is an open design, but they don't fit any other standard. Those two headers, my understanding, are for an upcoming camera module and an upcoming display module for the Pi.
I'm powering mine over USB, not mini USB.
You don't have?
On a Raspberry Pi.
You've just got
USB.
The USB plugged in. You're not plugged into the Raspberry Pi's official power port. You've got a powered USB hub plugged into the USB port. Good to know. You just got rid of one cable from my Raspberry Pi setup. Because I have a USB hub plugged into my Pi because I got a lot of crap plugged in. Okay, what's missing? No case. No power supply, but the BeagleBone can be powered over the USB console connection. The Pi, you don't get the SD or SDHC card. By the way, let me back up to the BeagleBone for a minute on that front. Well, it comes with a 4 gig micro SD. If we come over here, you will see. Yep, there we go. We lost communication with the Raspberry Pi. That is one of those network dropouts. So no more Raspberry Pi demos tonight. Oh, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just a regular network timeout. Let me see here. Yeah, just a timeout. I may be able to get back to the Pi. So here we are in the BeagleBone. And I've got an 8 gig micro SD in it. And you can see I've used 3.4 gig. Don't have ports on here. I do have kernel and world sources on here. So you can see if you were trying to build world on here, if you went with the 4 gig card that's supplied with it, you wouldn't be able to do it. So I recommend that if you're going to start playing with the bone, and you've got any thought of doing any work directly on the device as opposed to cross-compiling, you want to have at least an 8 gig micro SD. I personally, at this point in retrospect, would go for a 16 or a 32 gig micro SD because we still don't have the working USB on the BeagleBone. Okay. All right, and like I said, not supplied on the Raspberry Pi USB console. Most of the vendors that sell Raspberry Pis sell this little adapter that you plug onto a handful of the GPIO connectors on the Raspberry Pi, and it gives you the exact same USB console access that you have on the BeagleBone. You know, basically the BeagleBone just has that chip that's at the end of that cable embedded on the board, as opposed to you having to buy the chip and supporting electronics separately and plug it onto the GPIO bus. As I said a moment ago, nice thing to have for the BeagleBone, a larger micro SD card. I wouldn't run with the 4 gig if I was trying to do anything reasonable on FreeBSD. If I was setting the thing out there as a single purpose box, then 4 gig is enough, because when I first built my image, I think my image was all of a couple hundred megs. So 4 gig is enough if you're going to build your stuff someplace else and transfer it over to the box and run it as a simple single embedded purpose box. Okay. How do you get the disk image? Well, the most popular way assumes you have a working FreeBSD machine on an x86 or an AMD64 platform. You grab Tim Kinsel's toolkit, a single Bourne shell script, and basically it takes care of the magic. Now, I went back and forth with poor George for about a week and a half, 2 weeks after I got my board. George, what do I need to do to build a cross compiler for this thing? I've never set up cross compile on FreeBSD. Give me a hint here, Bob. And George just kept saying, did you run Tim's script? So finally, I ran Tim's script.
There's something to this programming.
Yes. But finally, I ran Tim's script. And the beauty of Tim's script is, if it's missing anything, it comes out and it says, hey guy, you need this. Go install it and then try again. Or you need that. Go download it and try again. Including if you don't have kernel sources on your machine and you don't have world sources on your machine, it'll come back and tell you. Now, caveat on that point is, you need to be working from head, not stable. This is not in the stable branch yet. So you're going to need to go into Tim's script, set the path to where you've got the head sources, and you'll have to set a few more things. I haven't detailed all of them because, as I said, if you listen to George's good advice and just run the script, it'll tell you.
We'll read the script, that's all.
Well,
the script is so explicit.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Now, I also mentioned here, read the docs, because things change quickly. I mean, it's been a matter of 6-8 weeks, and Tim's script has gone from supporting 2 machines to supporting about 8 machines and more options in it. And everything's set by setting a variable up near the top of the script. You know, it's very well defined. The man knows how to write good shell code. I've provided the URL there in case you don't know where to get head source. There you go. That's where to get head source. One of the little challenges that we have in the land of FreeBSDs these days, sort of a chicken and egg thing that we had for a long time with CVS until CSUP was included in base. Well, now SVN is the preferred way to get the sources, and of course SVN isn't in base. You gotta have ports and build it and so forth. It takes a lot of space, whatnot. If you're looking at just getting head and getting started, you can just grab it by FTP from the FTP server.
SVN up is in the ports and it may be moving into the base.
Yes, SVN up is in ports, but it's still pretty big. Still pretty big. SVN ends up being bigger than the base distribution.
Yeah. So there's a new thing called SVN up.
Okay,
stuff or CBSF. It does a similar task, but using SVN.
Okay, I'm sorry. That totally went over my head, George. I apologize.
And it may be going into base.
Ah, well,
that's from the nice book, Irish and Child.
Okay, cool. All right.
It does. Excellent.
But there is something to the ease of use to see stuff.
Yeah.
Having SVN up will be useful.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Our protests work.
So now we have a disk image. And now is sort of subjective because it'll be hours or days depending on the speed of your compile machine. In my case, I built on a 500 megahertz Pentium 2, and it took me over a week because that machine wasn't stable and kept crashing. What do you do with it? Well, you stick a card reader into the machine, stick a card into the card reader, and you DD the image file produced by TinScript right out to the card. Give another little caveat there. Remember when you set the size of the image in TinScript that whatever image size you set is the same or smaller than your card. A lot of these card makers lie about their size of their card. They think a gig is 1,000 as opposed to 1024. If in doubt about how big your card really is, DD your card out to some disk space on your big machine and see how big it is and use that as the figure to plug into TinScript.
Diskinfo-B.
That too. Assuming that they're not lying.
They can't lie with Diskinfo, can they?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, they can.
More common with large block access devices. That's why I said DD.
Trust nothing, verify. Okay, so we're ready to boot. What do? Stick your card in, hook up your network cable, because these images are set to automatically configure the interface and do DHCP for you, so you should have working networking if you've got a DHCP server. Connect up a console using whichever console method and power it up. The act of connecting up the console on the BeagleBone will power the BeagleBone up. So effectively, it'll start booting before you can actually start up Kermit or TIP or CU or whatever your favorite communications program is. And you should get a login prompt in basically no time. These things boot amazingly fast. If you don't get a login prompt, you should get something that will give you some clue as to what you need to do. And the what you need to do tends to be not too much different from what you're expecting on x86 machines. The biggest problem that I've seen has been on my Raspberry Pi not being able to mount root. And that's usually a temporary USB glitch, and it's just a matter of rebooting the machine, powering it off, powering it back on, and the next time it boots. If you find that you've booted and, oh golly gee, your kernel isn't named kernel, it's named kernel.pickle or something, well, you'll be able to go through the appropriate steps like you would on an x86 box to load the kernel, to get yourself in and rename things, whatnot. What now? Treat it like you would any other FreeBSD box. Install software from ports, do a port snap fetch. Get the ports out there. I would recommend putting ports on a device other than your root device. But if you got a really honking big root device and you're running on a bone and don't have USB support, that might be where you end up having to put it. In my case, I'm doing everything on non-rotating media just because that's a current preference of mine, just to see what the trade-offs are and whether I can live with non-rotating media. But you could just as easily, at least on the Raspberry Pi, plug in a big honking rotating drive and have the same disk I/O capability as you would expect from a USB connected disk on something else. Try things out, report problems, report successes to the mailing list. You report problems on the mailing list, chances are very good that somebody else is going to take an interest in that, try it themselves. You may get an email back within a couple of days saying, hey, can you try this patch? Right now, this guy Ray over in, what is it, Ukraine, George?
I'm not exactly sure where he is, but somewhere not in Central Europe.
Yeah. I know he speaks Russian because he comes on in the morning his time and types into the chat channel Dobre Ramo, which is good morning in Russian and Slovak and a couple others. So he's somewhere over there in Eastern Europe. You know, he's after me now to try a couple patches, you know, on things that I put out on the list that were not working for me. So just by being an ordinary user, firing the thing up and trying to do the things you want to do and putting feedback out there, you're helping the effort. You know, one of the constant issues is developers don't get good feedback from people. You know, and if they're working in a vacuum, they're not going to know. You know, at work, I've been pounding on the developers on a particular project that I won't mention here because I've been told I can't mention it. That, hey, you guys rolled out this 1.0 release or something, but you didn't think about the sysadmins that have to implement it. What about X, Y, and Z from a sysadmin point of view? Oh, nobody said anything about that to us. So now is really the time for guys like us to be playing with this stuff so you can give the feedback to the developers so that if something needs to change, they do it now instead of 6-8 months, a year down the road when it's harder to change. The other thing is you can help with documenting stuff. There's almost no documentation specific to FreeBSD ARM. Now, obviously, the general FreeBSD docs apply to various things, you know, how to set up Kerberos, this, that. But, like, for instance, there's not a real good all-inclusive how to do X on a BeagleBone, how to do Y on a Raspberry Pi with FreeBSD. Documentation of that sort would probably help this project catch fire a little better. Okay, resources. The ARM IRC tends, for whatever reason, is named HashBSD MIPS on EFNet. There seems to be a lot more ARM talk there than there is MIPS talk at the moment. Of course, it's subject to change, and I have seen MIPS-specific stuff there, but I am on there probably 12 to 18 hours a day, and it's mostly talk about ARM. Obviously, EFNet has nodes all over. I happen to use EFNet XS4all.nl, but you know, any EFNet, you can get to the BSD MIPS channel. Mailing list, list.freebsd.org. There is a FreeBSD ARM mailing list. It's active. I see stuff on it all the time. Some of the stuff is stuff that is at a level that me, as a sysadmin and not really a kernel hacker, I don't understand. I don't have a clue as to what these guys are talking about. A lot of other stuff I do understand. And opinions are welcome. Feedback is welcome. The FreeBSD ARM guys are very welcome. Very welcoming and very open, and want a lot of collaboration. This gentleman, Gonzo, who's actual name escapes me at the moment, but you'll see him on the list as Gonzo. You'll see him on the IRC as Gonzo. Actually, Gonzo minus sign. His website is kernelnomicon.org, and he makes posts there from time to time on work in progress on FreeBSD ARM. He's doing development on the BeagleBone. He's doing development on the Pi and the Panda and a couple other things. He's got a few things. A lot of the people that are heavily involved with the real hardcore internal type stuff on these ARM, on this ARM development issue, are guys that work for companies that build embedded devices based on these boards. Gonzo, for instance, works for a company that makes embedded devices based on ARM, and he's working on the USB on the BeagleBone right now, and he's got access to a USB analyzer, which is going to be invaluable in getting the BeagleBone's USB running. In case I didn't say, one of the reasons that the Raspberry Pi has working USB now and the BeagleBone doesn't is to get almost anything working on the Pi, you have to have USB because a lot of its onboard stuff is USB connected. Tim Kinsel's build script is on GitHub. That would be the place to grab his build script if you've got a working FreeBSD machine with either an AMD 64 or a x86 processor and you want to cross-compile. The other way of doing that, if you don't have one of those, although I can't imagine anybody here that wouldn't be able to lay their hands on one, except maybe me, since I'm trying to phase out my older, bigger, power-hungry boxes. You know, you can actually now run FreeBSD in the Amazon cloud, as I'm sure some of you know. Micro instances don't cost that much. You spin up a micro instance for a week, build your stuff, and shut it down. And there is a pre-built 4-gig image for the Raspberry Pi. And that's actually what I started my Raspberry Pi with, is that pre-built 4-gig image at that URL there. It's a very skinny image. It, interestingly enough, does not have man installed. One of the first things I did after bringing the image down, of course, was to pull in World, and I built man and installed the man pages because I like having the man pages available. They don't take up that much room. So it is pre-built for 4 gig. Rumor has it, those of you that are better with the current disk technology than me will know better than I, but rumor has it that you can grow the file system if you have an 8 gig or a 16 gig card. I have not tried growing the file system, but rumor has it you can. Rumor has it you can even grow a live file system. So, you know, if you have a bigger card, you could probably even start out with the pre-built image and grow the file system. Yeah, George.
There's also a site that I mentioned quick on talk today, but it's arm.dicepro.org. It is not up and functional. I think because we're using an old A3 machine for the build box and not using current, the Raspberry Pi builds are crashing. But we have twice daily 4 gig BeagleBone images being downloaded. Being built, and we just download a DD. There's changes that have to be done to it, but overall it's operational, and you know, certainly test it out. Every image is not tested, but it's running SVN twice daily, updating the base, the source, the previous source for it, and boom. So it's there and it's easy to use. Arm.nicebug.org. Arm.nicebug.org.
George, you should have told me before.
George, I told you about this actually before. You're the first person I talked about this.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, well, that just goes to show that my gray matter is becoming soft. Okay, so what's the conclusion here? Well, having free software choices on open hardware is important. At least I think it's important. You know, right now we're sort of going down this path where Microsoft is literally trying to lock everybody into only being able to run Microsoft Windows on computers, unless you somehow pay them a tax to run what you want, and then you can run what you want with some hassle factor. I haven't actually tried running any free software on a UEFI box yet, but all reports I've seen, it's not pleasant. The non-Intel based UEFI boxes that are designed to run Windows, like Windows tablets and such, they are actually locked up to the point where you can't load alternative software on them because you can't change the embedded keys in the firmware, and you can't turn off that key checking. So if we're going to continue being able to work with free software and develop free software, we need to have free hardware. If we want more than one choice on our free hardware, well, we've got to be the guys that get it done. Otherwise, the only choice is going to be whatever flavor of Linux the free hardware vendor wants to support. Now, that's not a bad thing. You know, the source code for GNU Linux is out there. Anybody can grab it, do almost whatever they want. But there are advantages to having software under other licenses available, like the BSD license. You don't have to be a core developer to be useful in this project. You know, a hardcore developer. You can be a guy like me. When people ask me what I am, I say, well, you know, I'm a systems administrator that can do a little bit of programming. You don't even have to be at that level. As long as you can reasonably communicate with people and you can be accurate about what you see when you try things, the developers that are working on this stuff really hardcore, they want feedback. And there's not enough people testing this stuff. What else? It's loads of fun. I started out years ago in computing with relatively small, relatively not powerful boxes doing really cool stuff. I brought up the first public access to the internet on a 6809 running at 2 megahertz with 512 kilobytes of memory. And I think maybe 2 megabytes of disk. You don't need a lot of resources to do a lot of cool stuff. These things, you can do lots of cool stuff with something that's inexpensive and a quantum leap more powerful than the machine that provided the first public internet access in the city of New York. You know, more than a quantum leap more powerful. You know, my Raspberry Pi, now that I've gotten word that that was the last thing I got before I shut down my laptop to come here tonight. X is now working under FreeBSD on the Raspberry Pi. One of the developers announced it in the chat tonight, wants people to start testing it. There'll probably be an email to the mailing list tonight or tomorrow. Now that X is going, as soon as sound is working on the Pi, my Raspberry Pi is going to become a little entertainment kiosk hanging off my TV. Why? Well, I'm using my TV as the monitor anyway. I might as well play YouTube videos on it or something, you know? Any questions that haven't been asked so far? All right, George is trying to get rid of me.
That was three questions.